Okay. Hey, Almighty Ballin' fans, listeners, everyone out there, happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Kwanzaa, that's holiday. Winter solstice. What all New Year's, that's under happy holidays.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think it's mostly supposed to be Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa.
Yeah, well...
At least two of which are currently happening. I'm not sure about Kwanzaa.
However you choose to spend your time indoors with loved ones, you know, roasting chestnuts by the fire, an act I've really never done. I really appreciate you taking the time to stop roasting your chestnuts for a little bit and listen to Unguarded Shooting with me, Chris Axman, executive producer, I guess, of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, and my host and editor-in-chief, Michael Luxemburg. Michael.
Hey, it's me. It's me again.
That should come as a surprise to you listeners, because it shouldn't come as a surprise to you listeners. Well, so I feel like Michael put it best when I asked him whether he watched all five games, and he said, yes, I watched them all and took it straight to the dome. Yeah, man. There's so much overwhelming basketball information. I mean, as much as I'm sure you and I would love to go over all five games, I think we narrowed it down to the three best to touch on for a little bit. Maybe we'll briefly mention a couple of the other ones, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like I've been saying all day, I'm Jewish, it's Christmas, I have nothing to do. So I had plenty of time to watch basketball, and I'm still pretty flexible even now.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not Jewish.
You still managed to fit it in.
Yeah, and that's how dedicated I am to Almighty Ballin'. And that's why, you know, you should listen to this podcast, follow at Almighty Ballin'. Check out the rest of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. And, you know, come January 1st, I think that's when I'm going to really start ramping up the live reads. I want to finish setting up the A-Team on AlmightyBaller.com, the A-Team being our team-oriented podcasts. And then I'm going to really hunt for those live read sponsorships. So once that's the case, you know, you can support us by listening and by going and using some fabulous products. So I think we're going to start with Celtics-Knicks.
Yeah, chronologically it makes the most sense.
I love chronology. When I was, you know, in eighth grade English, and they were saying how you should organize a paper, I always went chronology. You know, makes the most sense to me. You know, time. I live within the constraints of time.
That's fair. Time is a key with four sides. We don't need to get into that.
You know, actually, time is, I think, key with this New York Knicks team. In fact, the separation of time between the primes of their star players. I mean, there's really this weird shotgun effect where you look at Derrick Rose, you look at Chris Stapps, and you look at Carmelo Anthony, and all of them, you know, they're probably going to have some point in their careers. You know, Derrick Rose was an MVP. Carmelo Anthony, you know, was fantastic and still is, not quite as good. And then Kristaps Porzingis, I think, is going to be amazing. I'm even higher than the consensus, which is pretty high. But, like, they don't all align really well. And I think the biggest victim of time in this case is their defense. And I think that they just sort of were picked apart by the Celtics team. I mean, what did you come away with that game from?
I mean, there was definitely a big part of that game was the Celtics' ability to sort of get what they wanted on offense, because the Knicks were going under a lot of pick and rolls, leaving a lot of open space for those 3-point shooters to operate. And the Celtics were missing shots for a while, and they started making shots, and then they made enough of the shots. But the other thing that took away that was very stood out in a huge way was that when the Knicks really dedicated to the Carmelo Porzingis interior offense, the Celtics had couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
The whole Knicks comeback in the fourth quarter and all the other times they sort of trimmed the lead largely had to do with either Kristaps, Melo, or both of them controlling the paint against a pretty inferior Boston front court. But then, you know, like I said, Boston got shots. I mean, Marcus Smart made the decisive three. You know, like, yeah. It was that kind of game. Like, shots were falling sometimes, not other times. Weird guys were hitting big shots in weird times. It was, you know, it was a strange game, but it was exciting. I mean, went down to the final minute.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and I think in a lot of ways it was kind of an odd one. So I read this article coming into this, podcast, an article by Mike Vorkunov. I was saying Mike Vorkunov deck because it says December 25th and it shortens it to deck and whatever. Facing another measuring stick, Knicks come out on the short end against the Celtics. All right. And I thought that this was really, you know, encapsulated what happened tonight with the Knicks and Celtics. So, what the two, with 1 minute and 6 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter of their Christmas Day matinee, Knicks and the Celtics were back where they started, tied again after nearly 47 minutes of a game that tipped off shortly after noon and blah, 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 quieted. What the two possessions also showed that while the Knicks have star power, the Celtics seem to have a better grasp of on-court patience. The first of the two crucial possessions came up with the score tied at 1-1-2, 1-1-2 in Boston with the ball. The Celtics whipped the ball around and nearly ran the Knicks defense ragged until Marcus Smart, with the sixth pass of the possession, hit an open three-pointer to put the Celtics ahead. When the Knicks came down the court, there was little of the cohesiveness, but I think it's cohesion, that Boston had just displayed. Instead, the Knicks' possession ended clumsily with Carmelo dribbling along the baseline and looking trapped until Boston's Avery Bradley dislodged the ball and sent it rolling into teammate Jay Crowder's hands. So, you know, the reason why I wanted to, you know, read that whole big, long, blah, blah, blah dissertation thing is that I really do think that that sort of encapsulated, like, what happened tonight. You know, throughout the entire game, there were a ton of Celtics that were scoring. You didn't really know who was going to take the shot. Al Horford, after the game, actually said, "I was supposed to take the shot on that inbounds play. I believe it was an inbounds play, but on that play, I was supposed to take the shot. But then I saw Marcus Smart wide open, so I passed it to him, and he shot it." And Al Horford had 7 assists over the course of the game and had just a ton of really great counting stats. On the other hand, everyone knew exactly, and I retweeted something that Matt Moore said. There was something to the extent of, Avery Bradley knew and was able to predict what Carmelo was going to do because it was obvious to everyone in the world who was watching Carmelo at that time. Like, the Knicks just depend on Melo, Rose, Porzingis, and it's like they're all going to make their mark on the game regardless of whether that's the right thing for the team. So if one of them is dragging the rest of them down, then that really hurts the team. So despite all three of them being in, you know, double-digit scoring, over 20 points, all of them, Carmelo's, you know, inefficiency and turnovers, I feel like, really was the difference between a win and a loss in this one.
I generally agree with your characterization of that piece of text you just read, but I do have some issues with the piece of text you just read. Those being, I think it's two things. One is that, honestly, if you're playing the Celtics and you have to give up a three, Marcus Smart is probably the dude you want taking that three. He has a history of shooting very poorly.
Yeah, I think he's shooting 28% from three so far this year.
Right. So it's like, you'll take that shot. And the other thing I think that I think is going to be kind of forgotten in the discourse surrounding this game, because there was sort of this like very easily packaged ending and it's these two teams that we, you know, we like to compare and contrast, but like Porzingis had a block towards the end. And it was like maybe a 4 point, 5 point game. And it was called a jump ball incorrectly given to the Celtics. They then scored, and it would have been an easy layup on the other end for the two wide open Knicks players. And there were several moments like that, that just as easily could have changed the way the ending of this game went down. So it feels very weird to me to talk about this failure of execution on the Knicks' part. We definitely saw some of that, But we also saw some like real weird bad luck stuff happen to the Knicks that like you can't write off to like discombobulation. I mean, what you said about Carmelo though is obviously spot on. Because yeah, anyone watching that game and their pets knew exactly how the last Knicks possession was going to go. But I don't know. I feel strange neglecting to talk about how like how many weird things went wrong for the Knicks in the last like 5 minutes of that game.
Well, yeah, I do think it's worth mentioning though that a lot of things went right for them too, especially offensively. And I mean, this is a team that, you know, they're either leaving the game 16-4 or went into the game 16-4. So I mean, they're an above 500 record, but I mean, this team is now 3-10 against teams with records of 500 or above. So they beat bad teams.
I mean, I buy that.
I'm sorry?
So I buy that. That sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I was thinking about why that might be the case. And I was thinking, well, you know, the reason why even a guy like Eric Spoelstra, who is, you know, really smart about basketball, it's not like he thinks, okay, I'm just going to give it to Dwayne Wade and he's just going to do something and that's going to be the best way to end this possession. Like, it's not like he thinks, okay, this is the most efficient play possible because you could run a whole set and have some nice fancy ball movement and do all this stuff. But like, the last play of the game is different than all of the other plays of the game because the defense is super intense. You just want to give it to your guy and have him score because it's so hard to put five guys out on the court who are all not going to make a mistake. Like, you know, if you have Gordon Hayward, Hood, Hill, Gobert, and Ingles, and you pass the ball a lot on the last possession, Ingles is going to blow that play probably. So that's why you just want to give it to one guy and have an ISO possession, even though it's not the most efficient way to do it, because like you're so much more turnover prone. And if you want to ride, you know, one guy, you want to ride one guy. So I think that the reason why, the Knicks struggle against good teams is because regardless of whether good teams want to pass the ball around, their defense is so bad that they can't capitalize on the fact that somebody might make a mistake, because like at where a normal team would be like, okay, we really have to step up our defense. You know, maybe Derrick Rose and Carmelo Anthony and Joakim are playing better defense, but it's still so bad. I can't tell.
There is more to me, Queen Eliara of Elfgard, than my elven magic. Just as there's more to GEICO than saving you money, GEICO also gives you 24/7 access to licensed agents online, on the phone, or on the GEICO app. And while I am a mighty elf queen, I am also a mighty big fan of barbecue potato chips. Minions! More smoky mesquite!
GEICO. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Napa know-how!
Napa Guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how!
Hell. And then the other reason is, like, I think that conversely, I mean, Avery Bradley just took his lunch. And, like, if that had been James Harden, I don't think that would have happened. And, hey, here's the question I've got for you. If that had been Kristaps Porzingis, would it have happened? Would you have rather had the ball in his hands?
Maybe. I might have. I think, honestly, when it comes to the Knicks sort of late-game offense, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head in that, like, so you draw this like dipole, right, of teams that try to get the ball, move it around a bunch, hope no one makes a mistake, find a good shot that way, versus teams going sort of this ISO path towards the end of games. And the reality is that most teams kind of do a little bit of both. Like they have an ISO setup, and if that doesn't work, they have like a safety valve and a couple of options to like dish the ball somewhere.
Yeah, but just I just like, mean as a
backup
principle.
Plan. And that's not Right, but what I'm saying is I think that that's – and right, well, what I'm saying, you drew these two extreme dipoles. Neither really exists. But the Knicks basically did do that. Like, they didn't really have a safety valve plan situation. Like, no one was really moving. They were just like, Carmelo, do your thing. And if you need to, like, chuck it to someone who will force up a jumper, they can do that. But, like, I think that that's sort of – and it's hand-in-hand with the defensive issue, right? Like, it just sort of seems like the Knicks are in this really, like, let them just play basketball type of place. Which, like, I think is more viable. Like, actually, honestly, this speaks to your sort of thing about, like, the chronology of the Knicks team construction, right? Like, when you have a younger team, just let them go play is, like, a pretty viable move because there's so much for them to learn that, like, just being on the court and executing anything creates tangible progress. But, like... the Knicks aren't young enough for that to be a viable attitude, but they don't have like a discernible veteran team structure to build in like a culture, a strategy, like set of action sort of position. So they're in this like that gap in the chronology like manifests itself in tons of ways, sort of on the low levels of team execution for them, which is going to make it hard for them to be any more than just like pretty decent until they figure out like who they're building around and why.
It's a really odd situation. And you know, it's not like this is news to any of the listeners or anyone. The go-to joke going into the season was, you know, like this would be such an amazing team in 2012. You know, assuming that Kristaps was, you know, not 15, but I don't know. Maybe 14, 15 year old Kristaps would still be pretty good. But you know, that's something that we all understood. It's just that it's interesting to see it play itself out in such a profound way. And I feel like it goes both ways because it's like, well, you know, Derrick Rose can say, all right, well, you know, who was the last guy who had an MVP season? Oh yeah, that was me. And Carmelo Anthony can say, okay, who's the more proven scorer? Okay, that's me. And then Kristaps can say, you know, who is, like, the heir to the throne and maybe the most talented player on the team right now? And, yeah, that's Kristaps. So, it would maybe be good to have a chain of command in late game because I think that they have a lot of issues in late game execution that a team, you know, like the Grizzlies don't. Like the Grizzlies sort of knows that the collective hive mind of Mike Conley, Marc Gasol, the two of them are going to make every decision during the last 5 minutes. And, you know, the three guys around them are either going to act as appendages for achieving that, or they're going to be subbed out for Tony Allen or someone else who can do that. So, and it's like, if you say, okay, if Derrick Rose says, okay, you know, we're going to do my thing, come on, you know, team on three, let's go. I'm not sure that that's successful in the same way that I'm not sure if it's successful for Kristaps or Carmelo. But the thing is, they're all stars. I mean, certainly offensively. It's New York is an interesting team.
Well, I mean, those three guys at their best play off each other pretty effectively. It's just that they have these... offensively, yeah. I mean, defensively, there's some problems. But it's a real weird thing to me that, and it's especially weird, like, this exemplifies it so well, because the fourth quarter had large stretches where, like, Rose was breaking down defenders, finding Melo or Porzingis, who would then draw defenders and open up the other one to go do some work. Like, Porzingis and Melo had a run where they scored, like, all the points for, like, 6 or 7 minutes, and they were just, like, abusing the Celtics inside. And then as soon as it was like, oh, we need a bucket, they were like, oh, we're not going to do the thing that's been getting us buckets for 10 minutes straight. We're just going to throw it to Melo on the baseline. And obviously, like you pointed out before, there's a certain like conservatism that makes that the choice in certain cases. But like, weird. And this honestly, chronology of politics, to be honest, like more and more of this, like, we're gonna do the Melo thing this time, we'll do the Derek thing next time, we'll do the Kristaps thing this time after that. And there's like a reticence to be like, okay, we have these three dudes, let's run a three-tiered option that can include any of the three of them. Like, you see the Cavs do it all the time, where, like, their out-of-bounds plays have a Kyrie option, a Kevin Love option, a LeBron option.
Yeah, you remember that Toronto game we watched where Kevin Love got it at the top of the three-point line, and then Kyrie set, like, top of the free throw pick, and then LeBron came around the back and caught a lob from Kevin Love and then made that reverse layup. You remember that?
Right. So then you have suddenly have three options that are a Kevin Love three from the top of the key, a LeBron James cut, or Kyrie cutting to the corner. Like, those are three
Kyrie just shooting a mid-range jump shot from where he is.
Sure. Those are three very good options. None of which you get when you just throw it to Carmelo on the baseline and see what happens.
I think there was something weird with Carmelo today. Like, maybe he was hungover or something. His head was not in a great place. I don't think in terms of, like, making good decisions and stuff. He shouldn't have gone there, and he did willingly go there, and Avery Bradley let him go there. And by there, I mean, like, corner, like, into the corner, basically saying, like, hey, Avery, you want to trap me here? And then he was like, well, yeah, I guess I'll do that. And then I don't remember who it was who slid over to help, but Jay Crowder. Yeah, Jay Crowder slid over to help, and it's like, pass the ball, man. Like, Carmelo, move the ball to whoever your guy is supposed to be here, whoever's open, because someone's open. And he was like, nah, I'm just going to give it away, and that's going to be the right decision to make. And, I mean, I don't know. You know, it was 119 to 115. You know, it could have gone differently very easily. But, like, I think there is a reason it did go the way that it did. And even though it could have gone differently, I think that, you know, the majority of the time things play out, there's certainly a higher chance of something like this playing out than something that would be, like, you know, I think there was a very low chance that Carmelo was going to hit Kristaps for, like, an open layup there. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, and that's not good. That should not be the case.
Yeah, you definitely don't really want that. On the Celtics side, I mean,
Boogie. They need Boogie.
Yeah, I mean, they do. They need something, man. Like, Thomas was hitting, he was good. Crowder and Horford both played really well. Smart had a vastly above average for Smart game, but like the Celtics know, and everyone in the league knows, they can hit shots. They'll make the extra pass. They'll cut a bunch, but like that won't resolve their interior issues. Like no matter like they can a million cuts and they can shoot a bajillion jumpers over defenders going under screens, and they still will not be able to defend or score on the interior without a Boogie or a someone to do that.
Well, I mean, I think their offense is fine. And I understand why someone who isn't me could think to themselves, you know, this team thrived off of not having set rotations per se, but having like a set chemistry. Like every player on that team had been there last year, you know, when they had this really good defense. Every, you know, defensive cog of that team had been there and knew their role really well and interacted with one of each other and all fit really well into this, like, you know, okay, we're going to trap and then we're going to run and we're going to be aggressive type of scheme that they were playing. And, you know, it worked out really well for them because, like, of the specific players that they had, and now they have different players, and they added one player who Al Horford and a defensive scheme is not, I don't think, a good idea. I mean, Al Horford was really good in Budenholzer's scheme, which is like the least aggressive of schemes, right? I mean, Al Horford, in fact, has been really good in terms of help defense. I mean, he had three steals and two blocks from this game. Like, Al Horford has kind of actually shocked me in terms of his ability to be an off-ball shot blocker. So, you know, what does that mean, Lux? That means you need, like, an on-ball shot blocker. It means you need, like, a real rim protector. It means you need, like, you know, Boogie or Hassan Whiteside. Like, you need someone so that Al Horford can be your Hassan, not your Hassan, your Serge Ibaka, or, you know, your Anthony Davis or your Andre Kirilenko, like, except just offensively better than all those guys. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, it's interesting because I don't doubt that Brad Stevens has like a good grasp over all of this. I think that, you know, he made certain changes tonight that he felt like needed to happen for everything to flow well, but it's just like, you know, he just doesn't have the same chemistry, the same, like, the same bonus, you know, modifier thing that you can tack on to a team's talent just when they've played together long enough that they know each other's tendencies. And without that, like, we're again faced with, is this team that talented? And, like, not really.
No, not really. I mean, they're pretty good for a team in this year's East, but they're not good.
Yeah, yeah.
Per se.
And like, this was the night, you know? And I am in favor of not jumping to conclusions here. I think this might have been the second or third game of the entire season that they've had the hypothetical starting lineup all available, you know, and that they've had the five guys. It's like, I'm trying to remember, so the lineup that everyone thought was going to be so good going into the season was IT plus 3 and D, which is like Isaiah Thomas, Al Horford, Jay Crowder, Marcus Smart, Avery Bradley. That's pretty cool, right? IT plus 3 and D, right?
Yeah, it's pretty good lineup.
Yeah, so
nickname.
Yeah, and that has been either marginally positive or like negative. And like, I want to wait for that to thresh itself out because, like, you know, would you agree with me that, like, even though I might not buy it, I understand the argument that the Celtics, like Danny Ainge or Brad Stevens, could make that it's like, well, this time next year when we do have, you know, that, you know, chemistry build up and stuff, you know, right now our ceiling is a 50-win team. We can get all the way up to a 60-win team if everything is running perfectly. Like, I understand that argument. I'm not sure I buy it. I'm not sure if that's the right way to think about it. But, like, you know, I mean, do you get what I mean? Like, do you at least say it's valid?
I understand that in principle. I think you've talked about this before, but I am, like, a very firm believer in the idea that the threshold from 40 to 50 wins is a much easier one than from 50 to 60. And that's sort of the flaw I see in, like, the formulation you just gave. Because I think you're generally correct that, like, yeah, it makes sense that, like, you have these lineups. They're going to take a year to adjust. They're doing okay now. In a year, they'll probably be better across the board. That's fine. But I just don't think that, like, the talent level is there for the jump to be that significant. Right? Like, I think what you're saying is true, but just on a smaller scale, and I'm not sure on a smaller scale really does anything for me or the Celtics.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the problem, because, like, the difference is a 45-win team beats bad teams and occasionally squeaks out wins against good teams.
And then gets swept by the Hawks 2 years in a row.
Yeah, a 55-win team kills bad teams, does pretty decently with good teams. A 60-win team kills bad teams and beats good teams with notable consistency. I don't think the Celtics, even with another year together, have a roster that's going to beat good teams with notable consistency.
Sure.
But I mean, and like, I talked a lot about how, like, I think building around internal growth is a good idea for a team, but, like, who's going to make significant talent-wise jumps for the Celtics? You know what I mean? Like, chemistry bonus for sure, but, like, it's like, is Jay Crowder going to become, like, Kawhi Leonard, you know? Like,
I thought we were watching Kawhi Leonard to see if he could ever become Jay Crowder one day, if he eats his vegetables.
If he eats his reverse vegetables and does anti-exercises.
Yeah, yeah.
Downgrades a little bit.
Well, and, you know, like, the problem to me is, and this sort of crystallized to me just as we're sitting here right now, the problem to me is, like, the what happens when you build through internal growth in this Celtics team, you know, unless they get the first round pick next year and, like, you know, like Steph Curry, LeBron James draft pick, you know, set aside, like, as something we're not going to bet on, right? You know, based on their previous drafting history of success and the draft picks that they have accumulated, like, the rebuild iteration of this team is, like, literally the same team as this year. It's like Marcus Smart is, like, pretty good, and he has a lot of, like, great positives, but, like, he's about as talented as, like, Jay Crowder is positionally, you know, and, like, maybe Young takes the next step, but, like, you know, if the best player on your team, I mean, the very best thing that could happen is, I guess you could say, like, Kelly Olynyk ends up being, like, Al Horford, but, like, Al Horford isn't, like, getting it done, you know? There's no one on this team. There's no one on this team who, like, really makes the jump for them, right? But they have so many pieces that, you know, I mean, Avery Bradley's awesome. He's super underrated and all this stuff. And, I mean, Marcus Smart, like, you know, I understand why they haven't moved on from Marcus Smart and why they've been so loyal to him and why they've been like, oh God, if you can just hit a jump shot, it's going to be so great. Because, I mean, I think we saw tonight, right? Like, you know, they were running him and Gerald Green next to each other, and that was really great. It was like plus 17. The two of them were like plus 17 or plus, you know, Marcus Smart was like plus 17. And then I think Green was like plus 8. And then they rode their hot hands for a while because Gerald Green was also doing a whole bunch of, like, on-court stuff, a lot of great rebounds, all this jazz. But then they moved on from Gerald Green and then put Isaiah Thomas back in to play with Marcus Smart. And the reason for that was, it's like, well, now we've set this precedent with Marcus Smart that it's like the opposing team, you have to respect his jump shot. And, like, if you have Marcus Smart's effect on the game, which is, like, amazing defense, you know, 50-50 balls become 75-50 balls. You get tons of turnovers. He's going to, like, draw offensive fouls, like, all this stuff.
75-50?
What? Oh, 75-25.
He said 75. Yes. Yeah, he said 75-50 and it made me laugh.
75-25. If you get all this stuff, plus, like, he actually spreads the floor like a normal guard, and, like, if he's hitting all of his shots, then that's the effect he has. Then, like, he's, like, a star. Like, he actually is a star. It's just, like, the difference between a player who can hit shots and not hit shots is, like, the difference between, like, Brian Cardinal and Peja Stojakovic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we've been on this game for a while now. Should we go to the next one?
Well, so maybe we should leave... actually, we should not leave chronology. Let's make sure that we hit on the Warriors-Cavs game while we're still, you know, not... while we have full speed, you know, full speed.
Yeah, ahead. let's keep moving.
I think this was great. You know that Steph Curry got to hit that dagger three over Kyrie Irving and get revenge for what happened in the finals. I was really happy for him and the rest of the Warriors squad that they made such a resounding victory. What do you think?
I mean, yeah. It was crazy because that was the story of the game for a while. Like, until about partway through the fourth quarter, the whole thing was like the Cavs making runs, but the Warriors seem like pretty in control. Like, they're hitting shots when they need to hit shots. Even if, you know, it was a lot of like the kind of way that people have been talking about the Warriors a lot this season, which is like, even if Steph Curry looks not so great and Klay Thompson's kind of cold, they still have Durant, they still have Draymond, they still have that bench. But it's like, that's probably a fair way of analyzing them against every team that's not the Cavaliers.
Right.
But that's not a good way to do analysis against the Cavaliers, because the Cavaliers are super good. Like,
yeah.
They're comparably good.
Well, and you know what? Like, I think specifically, and I think you'll get where I'm going with this after I explain it. Maybe it won't make as much sense at first. I think it's specifically not a good way to evaluate the Warriors up against a team with LeBron James, because in that respect, in the respect of, oh, you know, everything is going well, we're executing our game plan, it looks like we're going to win, I feel like LeBron is the X factor that it's like LeBron was not going to get blown out. Like that he was just, that was not going to be acceptable to him. He like was like barking at his teammates when they weren't doing the right things. Like they rounded into form as the game went on because LeBron was like, hey, you know, you're doing the wrong thing. Here's what you're going to do now. And it's like, it was like a learning effort on court over the course of 48 minutes. And then the Y factor after the X factor was Kyrie. It's like LeBron will keep you there. And then Kyrie will just like cut your jugular once you're there at within the last 5 minutes, you know?
I mean, they both played, were fantastic. I just felt like the Warriors, like, it's like I, this is the most annoying sports commentatory thing to say, but I don't care. Like, it's like the Warriors are reading their own press. Like, when, because this happens,
Kevin,
right?
Durant does do that.
Yeah, that's true. So does Steph. So maybe they are, but
I think Steph reads his wife's cookbook, which well, I almost got for my mom for Christmas.
So close.
Socks, smart nice. Socks, smart wool. Nice. You know,
yeah, that's good stuff. That very intelligent wool scored well on its SATs. No, but this is what I mean is that, like, so the Warriors beat the Jazz by 5 in a hypothetical universe, and Steph plays poorly, and Draymond has a bunch of turnovers, so they still win. The reporting isn't like Steph looks whack or Draymond played poorly. It's Kevin Durant's there, so it's fine, or Klay's there, so it's fine. But it's like, they have to not think that way, because it felt like for a lot of this game, they were in this sort of like, we're the Warriors. We'll be fine. We got Kevin Durant. We got Draymond Green. We're good. And it's like, no, like Steph Curry turning the ball over and making bad decisions and taking bad shots is bad against really good teams, or Draymond Green passing up open looks or like rerouting the offense that's working well is bad against good teams. Or Andre Iguodala not being able to find space is bad against good teams. Like, against bad teams, yeah, the Warriors are good enough that two or three major things can go massively wrong for them and they'll still beat most teams, but not the Cavaliers. And that's how it felt today. It was like, Steph took bad shots, made bad decisions consistently throughout this game in a way that just felt like so dang lackadaisical. The same way that, like, I mean, this happened in the finals. Remember in Game 7, he, like, tried to, like, go behind his back to make a fancy pass, and then everything was just a disaster. Like, it was that kind of, it was that kind of business for, like, four quarters.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, yeah, I think that that's sort of why they, I understand at least why they get that characterization from people like Charles Barkley, you know, or like sports radio talk show host or whatever, that it's like, you know, they're mentally weak and they aren't like as, you know, they don't have that like fire in their gut, you know, that like killer instinct. I mean, that's what Tyronn Lue, you know, the first post game question he answered was something about Kyrie, which is unsurprising. And he was just like, Kyrie's a killer. And like, no one is ever going to question that. Like, Kyrie is so clearly a killer. Like, he just is a killer. But like, the thing is, he's not, it's not like an aesthetic thing. It's like, you know, he does a lot of the same things that Steph does. He pulls up from three, he does a whole lot of ball handling skills, he hits crazy angles on his layups. Like, you know, they do really similar things, but the difference is, like, you know, you never have to wonder, like, okay, is this Kyrie that we're seeing during the last couple of minutes, is this the best Kyrie that it's possible for us to see? Because I feel like the answer is yes. And like, you sort of see, I feel like, at least now, and I would need to think about it for a little bit, you know, to see if this is fair up against like old Steph last year, who was the most clutch player, you know, in the last 20 years or whatever. But it's like, he would hit those ridiculous pull-up threes throughout the entire course of the game. And like, then when it got to be clutch, he would just continue being amazing. But like, with Kyrie Irving, with LeBron James, with this Cavaliers team, it's like, there's them when they're good. There's like, there's regular them, right? That isn't as good as the Warriors. But like, their second gear, they're able to like ratchet it in and like kick it up a notch in a way that I feel like the Warriors aren't. So it's like their baseline talent like isn't on the level of the Warriors, but like their honed and refined talent almost is better.
Well, I feel like that's true in this way where like, cause I generally agree. I think an interesting or important addition to that is that like, so it feels like the Cavs can get into like you're saying this next gear by sort of like LeBron just like yelling or whatever, or like just like dadding everyone, just being like, it's me, Papa LeBron, game time. Like, let's turn on the Jets. Let's do this thing. Right. And like do that at the right moments. The Warriors, it feels like, don't have that. What they do have is like the better their offense is running, the better they play everywhere. Right. So once they start hitting some shots, they can become this like snowball death machine thing. And I think that even the best Cavs can't stack up to that when it's rolling.
Well, so I think that used to be the case, but like, you know, now it's like, you know, their centers, you know, are, I mean, they have more minutes with either, you know, a maybe like the best 3-point shooting pure five in Channing Frye ever. Like, I mean, really, because like there aren't a lot of like pure sniper fives. I mean, most are like stretch four, like four fives, like Mehmet Okur or whatever. But like Channing Frye in the modern NBA is a center. And, like, he hits, like, 50% of his threes from absurd places. And then Kevin Love is having an amazing three-point shooting year. And then Kyrie Irving has, like, always been, like, a 40% three-point shooter. And then Shumpert off the bench in a very particular role is also, like, a 40% three-point shooter. I think that LeBron, I mean, like, you know, I think we saw this new in the playoffs last year in the first round. You remember, I think it was against the Pistons, or maybe it was against the Hawks in the first round of the Eastern Conference playoffs, when the Cavaliers hit like 26 threes, like in the middle of the playoffs, just like on some random night. You remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
This new current iteration of the Cavs can snowball just like, or not just like the Warriors, but in similar way.
No, I agree with that. But my thing, I guess the thing I'm trying to draw is that when the Warriors snowball, I think no one's better. But the more significant point is that that's their only mechanism for like going into locked in mode. Like, it's not like with the Cavs who can just like get locked in. Like, the Warriors have to like do well at things for a little while to lock themselves in. And that's, I think, something the Cavs take advantage of, because the Cavs are really good at disrupting them and not letting them feel that way. And so then the Cavs have to play against regular Warriors, and the Cavs have a pretty decent shot at beating regular Warriors when they play.
Even if, like, it's just by 1 point.
Even if it's just by 1 point, like,
and even if Richard Jefferson fouled KD on the last possession,
debatable but reasonable.
It is debatable. That's the interesting thing. It's like, I'm sorry, listener, I don't have a hot take for you. I don't really know, but please continue. Sorry,
but yeah, but that's my point, right? That I think that in a world where they're able to get rocking, if they come out of a timeout, and I feel like this happened more last year, to be honest. They come out of a timeout. Steph Curry is like, all right, look, boys, I'm going to make this 48-foot three, and we're all going to get stoked on it, and then we're going to go on a run. It's happening right now. And then, like, they do it. That would be great, but I feel like that just doesn't happen for them the same way it did last year. And without that, they're just like, I don't know, like a regular – it sounds really dumb, but like a regular 68-win team. You know what I mean? Like – But you know what I mean, right? Like, they're just like a normal, like, there's nothing that makes them feel as juggernaut-ish, which is weird because they have Kevin Durant now, so you'd think that this would happen more often, not less. But, like, they're just, like, really, really good and not, like, terrifying. I don't know. It's weird to complain about them when they're, like, 27-5 and have, like, a historically good offense, but, like...
Yeah, they're still, So they're now 27-5. Yeah. So they have an 87% win percentage, which is compared to their 89% wins that they had when they were 73-9. So they're still on pace for like 67, 68, 69 wins. So
nice.
Yeah.
But
number
yeah,
one like, in points per game, number one in shooting percentage, number one in 3-point percentage, number one in points per game.
Well, like I said, I think, yeah, I mean, that's why I feel so silly, but I feel like it's largely an issue of perception. And I think you generally feel me on this, that like you can perceive, even in the viewing experience, a significant difference between Washington this year and last year.
With the Warriors?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I think that me and you, or you and I, both have the same difficulty with like putting our finger on why that's the case. And like straight up, man, what I've been considering more and more as like a real scenario is that like 82 games is a pretty big sample size, but like it's not so huge that like they can just seem magical if everything works out right. And I think they might have just last year had a magical season.
I'd buy that more if I was seeing some like magical games out of them. I feel like we've seen two or three this year, maybe.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying last season was just magical.
Right, but like
they're super talented, but everything had to go right last year for them.
I guess what I mean, right, sure. That's probably like that's almost certainly true. But what I mean is that like so if they were generally kind of magical and last year was a small sample that happened to include the peak amounts of magical on their bell curve.
Except
right?
For game 7.
Sure. There'd still be some residuals scattered throughout. And I think the drop off from this year where they've had like 3 or 4 really spectacular games out of 32 compared to like a bajillion last season. Makes me feel like there is something more fundamental than just like statistical noise happening here.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm not sure if you're driving towards this point. But like, I think the natural place to drive to that point, the natural place to go from here is like, okay, what is it? You know, what's, you know, from the Powerpuff Girls, like Chemical X, you know, that makes the Warriors into the Powerpuff Warriors. Like, Steph Curry just doesn't Steph anymore. And you made this point to me at the start of the season. And like, you know, I was like, okay, well, you know, this is true to a certain extent, but they're mostly just giving Kevin Durant the ball. And like, I'm not willing to say, okay, this guy's different than he was last year. And now 30 games in, like, I think we've seen a large enough sample size that like, okay, I'm willing to say like, you know, especially after this game, because if there was a game that you needed to be Steph and like go ham, like tonight was the night and he didn't do it. And in fact, like he had one of the worst games of his season, like 15 points on like kind of inefficient shooting. And like, he looked super mundane, you know, like it's like Curry is like the secret sauce, like the secret Curry spice that makes them, turns their like super awesome pumpkin into like a super amazing carriage thing. And like without that like ability to like just say, okay, well, you know, also we're this amazing team, but also just like, by the way, our best player might pull up for 40 on you and nail it. Like, that's the thing. I feel like that's the dynamic that's missing, if you ask me.
No, I mean, absolutely. Like, we talked about this last year a fair amount, just like on the Ultra, like a ton about how like when you game plan a NBA defense, you basically game plan from the 3-point line inward, or at least you used to. Like, that's the area where your system goes. But when Steph Curry is pulling up from 32 feet, like, your system has to account for that, but it can't without opening up a ton of extra space, which then creates all these crazy mismatches, especially when you have to go over pick and rolls to take your big man so far away. Then you have Draymond Green 4-on-3s and all this stuff that everyone loves. But this season, like, he's not doing that as much. It's not creating that same kind of spacing. And it's has the a clear negative effect on their ability to like go off in the exact same way.
Yeah. And it's harder to, I feel like it is harder to quantify, because like what we're describing is the ability or lack thereof to go into hyperdrive. And like the whole point of hyperdrive is that you don't go into hyperdrive very often, especially if you're a historically dominant team. Like there might be four or five games over the course of a season where like you need to go into hyperdrive, or like maybe 10 or 15, something like that. There's not a lot of opportunities to kick it into hyperdrive. So it's like, you know, it's harder. There's only been like three instances or something like that this season where it's really been like, you know, Curry, like you need to go into hyperdrive. Like you need to like do the thing that this team needs and like really take over. Because like a 72 win Warriors team, at least the team to get to that quality that they had last year, like you need superhuman Steph. So like do it. And like, I feel like there's been a few, you know, concerning instances of him not doing it, but then maybe today's game, this Christmas Day game, like maybe this is the conclusive, like, okay, sound the alarms. Like, you know, right now, for whatever reason, maybe injury, maybe or whatever, but right now, if the playoffs started tomorrow, you could not bank on it. And that is alarming.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's spot on, that like it's, we can't trace this deep enough to know exactly the causalities, but
Richard Jefferson.
Sure. Old man magic. But what we can like discernibly identify is just that like we're not seeing this same kind of floor stretching dominance from Steph Curry. Like, okay, if there's ever a testament to this, it's simply the statement that on almost every basketball writer's all NBA first team, or like all-star starters, best, you know, starting five conference thing, the starting guards are Harden and Westbrook.
Right.
For everyone. Like, and Curry won the last two MVPs. Like, and he won one unanimously. Like, the difference between being the unanimous MVP and being not even on the radar for starting guard in the All-Star game, according to, like, writers and things, like, even if his statistical difference isn't huge, the perceptual difference is vast, and that comes from him not making the kind of plays in the same way.
And now, insurance-minded speeches from GEICO.
It's a common expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. However, what if the horse's mouth is filled with useful insurance tools? This is the exact case with the GEICO app. Yes, the app is free and therefore a gift horse. However, look inside the app and behold, emergency roadside assistance, digital ID cards, bill pay. Get the GEICO app. Look it in the mouth. Get amazing services. Thank you.
Well, I think the thing is, though, that there is a sort of, there's like a superstar quality that everyone, you know, talks about it, as like something that you try to quantify, but is ultimately unquantifiable. Right. And like Steph's superstar moxie was like in his specific, unique, unmatchable, you know, totally unprecedented ability to just pull up from three and to basically say like, okay, you know, it's like he was like, you know, a time stopper or something. And he would just press pause on the game, on the offense and the defense. And then like, he's freely moving in time and he just like, you know, nails the three. And it's like, okay, like, come on. Like we're, you know, press play again. Everyone's now running, but like, oh, by the way, we have nine extra points. Sorry about that. Like, you know what I mean? And like, meanwhile, LeBron, like his like preternatural ability is like basically everything. It's not like that, but I mean, defensively he has this absurd thing and I think he has this effect on his teammates. You know, I was going to run this by you, but I'll finish my point first. Kyrie, and LeBron both still have that, you know, superstar effect or quality or whatever. And like, I feel like the Cavaliers can They literally took Draymond out of the game in the first quarter by getting him in foul trouble and giving him a tech, right? Klay Thompson, I feel like, has never really had that, like, super-duper star quality to him. And then it's like, well, Kevin Durant has this weird Achilles heel where he was amazing and perfect for the Warriors all game long until the last 5 minutes when he missed. He went 0 of 2 and, like, was a negative 5 or so, maybe negative 6. But go ahead.
On the Kevin Durant thing, I think that's, like, there was a point in that game where it just felt like the Cavs were, like looked at each other and they were like, yo, Steph's not going to beat us. Klay's not going to beat us. Draymond's not going to beat us. The only person who might beat us is Kevin Durant. So, like, do not let that happen. Because he just became, I think, the focal point of their defense towards the end of the game. In a way that spoke to a sort of, like, a certain degree of confidence, I guess, in their ability to check the rest of the Warriors lineup, which is just not something that we see that often.
You don't see a lot. I guess sometimes you do see it. I'm not used to seeing teams decide, okay, we're going to close in on a guy who's driving the lane. In this instance, it's Kevin Durant, but this happened to Draymond too. We're going to close in and then get out on contests. You don't see that work with the Warriors very often, which is why it's so scary. But like, it works for them. They make that work. Like, they do a really good job of, like, sprinting out of their, you know, helps. Like, it's pretty insane. Can I like run this idea by you that I had?
Yeah, shoot.
Okay. So, I think that, like, psychologically, LeBron is like Phil Jackson, right? And Kyrie is like Kobe, right? Where, like, you know, LeBron, like, plays this, like, psychological puppet game with, like, both teams, right? His team and the other team, like, motivating, but also, like, putting up posters of, like, him blocking Steph in the opposing locker room. Like, you know, pregame quotes, like, cryptic tweets. Like, he does this whole Phil Jackson Zen Master thing, right? And then it's like Kyrie is this Kobe Bryant where, like, he also is a psychological weapon, but, like, he's not as he's more of like a blunt. He's more of like a just like a silver bullet type of one where it's like his psychological weapon is that, like, he will always, like, leave psychological tension completely unscathed. So it's like, you know, the Cavs create all this tension and, like, weird, you know, melodrama and stuff, and then rely on, like, LeBron's ability to be above it all, right? Kyrie's ability to just, like, be completely unfazed by it. And then now, the highest plus minus on either team was Kevin Love, and now Kevin Love is, like, the, you know, okay, well, yeah, dude, sure, whatever, man, I'm cool. Like, I get it. I get that this is what we're doing. It's like he's in on it now, you know what I mean? And, like, yeah, well, they just get in the Warriors' head, I think.
Well, it definitely, I mean, I think yes to both. I mean, they definitely seem to have their dynamic as a team figured out pretty well. And, like, the way the personalities, you know, fit. And then, yeah, it seems like LeBron and Kyrie have just, like, bought a timeshare in the Warriors' minds and, like, hang out there a couple times a year and just, like, trash it real bad. Because, I mean, it's hard to conceive of, like, another explanation for what happened today. Like, towards the end, the Warriors had, like, a double-digit lead at a point, and they still looked like they thought they were going to lose.
Dude,
they did.
There was that one picture of Steph with, like, his head in his hands, like on the bench because he got subbed out. Like, you know, like, that last play of the game, he got replaced with Sean Livingston when they were reviewing the Klay Thompson corner three that the time expired on.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, he got subbed out for that and they put in Sean Livingston. Right. And, like, there was this picture I saw on Twitter of, like, Kyrie as he started his drive towards Klay Thompson in that final play. And you see Steph Curry over on the bench, like, in the background, just with, like, his hands in his head, like, just like, oh God.
Yeah, no, it really seemed like they thought they were donezo. before they were even really losing by very much, or losing really at all. But they seemed to like treat their losses like a foregone conclusion in the last like 5 minutes of that game, and it was real weird to watch.
Yeah, it was very PTSD. You want to move on to the Lakers? Do we even talk about the Lakers Clippers?
Yeah, let's just give it a quick hit real fast, and then we call it a night. So I think, the one major takeaway from this game for me, the Lakers broke a little losing streak, both in general and against the Clippers tonight. They won 111-102. So this game, I think, put the lie to a thing that people say a lot that I do not understand, where they're like, DeAndre Jordan got to be in the discussion with, like, Boogie and Karl Anthony Towns and Gobert and blah, 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 and Gasol is, like, the better centers in the league. And it's like, absolutely not. He is very good at traditional center-y things. That's obviously true. He blocks a lot of shots. He plays good defense. He gets a lot of rebounds. But, like, that dude could not generate offense without Chris Paul and Blake Griffin on the floor.
Well, he actually got 5 assists, but like it was clearly not a weapon that they were using. They were just like, oh, cool, he got an assist. So like, I wasn't sure where you were going with that, and I think I agree with you now that.
Well, yeah, the assists he got like weren't. I mean, they were decent, but they were mostly like, oh, someone drove and hit me a dumb pass and their man double teamed me. I'll just like kind of whoop, here you have it back. Or like, here's the pass and the guard cuts behind me and D'Angelo Russell goes to double team and like, yeah, you can have it back. Like they weren't, it wasn't like he was like spotting crazy cutters or like making these like really insightful moves out of double teams. It was like, there was a wide open guy 5 feet away from him next to the basket. And he was, which like, to be fair, like props to DeAndre Jordan, get that man the ball. Like that's good work. But it was just very clear that, like, without, like, he couldn't create offense on his own. Without someone to get him the ball, he had a hard time even finding ways to get the ball for himself. And then, like, once the Clippers, like, took him out, they had their, like, most effective stretch of the second half.
With most Bates. Like, most Bates was creating offense, like, in a real way. And Brandon Bass had that really. Like, had that weird Brandon Bass dribble drive game going on. That was weird.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of weird stuff like that. Ingram had a pretty wacky game, too. Mozgov and Dang were kind of the heroes for the Lakers, which was bizarre to watch. But, I mean, that's like, there's not much else to take away from this game, just except for that, like, DeAndre Jordan's very good as half of a duo. DeAndre Jordan as a singular entity is just like pretty good.
Yeah.
He's amazing as half of a duo. He fits perfectly with both Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, but on his own, he's like not a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that like for as dire of straits as Sacramento finds themselves in right now, replace DeAndre, or replace Boogie with DeAndre, like now you're screwed. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying is that like,
yeah, that,
what?
That's the exact comparison I was actually making in my head while I was watching that game. I was like, DeAndre looks like kind of butt right now. I mean, he's fine, but he doesn't look great. And then the little voice in my head was like, well, like, you know, like the Clippers don't have anyone on the roster. Their two best players are hurt. They're playing with this weak bench. And I was like, yeah, that's true. And then a second later, I was like, wait, Boogie plays with like comparable surrounding talent every dang night and puts up like 30 and 12. So I don't think DeAndre Jordan really needs my sympathy in this respect.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's like an interesting point worth making too. Because it's like, you know, you were sort of saying, well, you know, he wasn't really doing anything spectacular. He was just passing, out of the paint. Well, it's like, you can, if you move that like 10 feet back to the free throw line and say, okay, do that from this entire space. But also you're not just going to have one nice night distributing the ball out of, you know, the paint. You're going to just be one of the best big man passers. Like, you know, now you have Marc Gasol after you add like you know, all of these skill sets to like, oh yeah, and you're one of the best defensive bigs in the game. Like, it's no small jump. Like, it's like he has some qualities that are elite, but elite centers are supposed to have multiple elite qualities. I would probably say that DeAndre is elite, but like in a very limited way, I would say.
Together, we can make your blonde. Sheer Blonde Go Blonder Collection by John Frieda lightens and brightens hair 2 full shades to give you your best blonde every day.
Hair talks. Make your statement with Sheer Blonde Go Blonder Collection, only from John Frieda.
Napa Know How.
The Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how!
Yeah, he's elite in a very specific context. Yeah. But that's really all I had to say about that game. I mean, like, a bunch of scrubs from Los Angeles played a bunch of scrubs from Los Angeles and one team won.
I had one thing to say about that game that was in reference to the Timberwolves, which played before against the Thunder. Like that fourth quarter super collapse, like the dwarf star imploding that happened in like the fourth quarter. It's like during the third quarter, the Timberwolves did their whole like, oh, we're melting, like Wicked Witch of the West thing. And then in the fourth quarter, it like really, like the structure started falling apart. Like it just didn't look like the Lakers were going to do that. And like that, this line of thinking made me so much more concerned about like whether or not Thibodeau is going to be an elite coach in Minnesota than I've been up to this point. Because like, you know, they're both rookie coaches on their teams. The only difference is that Luke Walton is a chill bro and that his players say in press conferences that they would run through walls for him. And then Tom Thibodeau does not have that type of rapport. And I think I'm a little bit more concerned about that than I was prior to watching, those two games back to back.
I think that's valid. I think for me, it feels like just thinking about like the nature of like the person, like the interpersonal relationships, like evolving there. It feels to me like Luke Walton walking into coach a young team seems like the easiest space to create a connection between a coach and a player in the universe. Right. Cause he's like,
it's as easy as passing a blunt.
Well, right. Cause they're smoking a bunch of weed, but also he's showing up and he's like, look, I've been an assistant for all this time. Like I've been trying to do it, but like, haven't done it yet, but I'm trying real hard, trying to make a name for myself. Here's this roster full of young dudes, haven't done it yet, but they've got the talent, trying to make a name for themselves. Like, we're doing the same thing together. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know any more than you guys. Like, we're, like, learning together. We're, like, growing. Like, it's a really easy situation to make everyone feel comfortable and to buy in, like, feel really loyal to each other. With Thibodeau, it's like, I am your angry stepdad. I know exactly what's happening. You will obey me at every turn. Whether or not he's exactly like that, but the gist being that like his time and his experience and his like traditionally working with veteran teams, I think is going to give him a much longer learning curve to be able to communicate and to get his team on board with him at the Wolves than with Walton and the Lakers. So I think that like your concern is founded, but I think that Thibodeau with a little more time could get his team there.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess like, you know, it's something I'm going to keep track of.
That's worth it.
Yeah, and we'll translate out of this. It's just like, you know, I've talked a little bit about the Nuggets recently, just as an example. And like Mike Malone's like not like a dingus, but like he's never going to be one of the top 10 smartest coaches in the league at any given time because like he's just not that great of a coach basketball IQ wise. He's never going to be bottom 5 either, and like, he's apparently like a really positive, awesome guy. But like a coach like that though, can lose the ear of the locker room and his team can just give up on him because like you can make the leap to this guy is just like a dumbass and like doesn't know what he's talking about. And like traditionally that's the way that you lose the locker room, is that everyone on the team just decides that you're a dumbass, or that like you're George Carl and you're toxic. So like the dumbass thing is never going to happen, but like is like Thibodeau in the modern NBA coaching arena, is that too toxic for the modern NBA player to deal with? And like, I don't know the answer to that. I assume that the answer is no, that it will work itself out, like what you were saying, but like, I am concerned in a way that I didn't expect to be. But
I mean, I think we're seeing proof of this thesis that I just sort of put forward, this like half baked thesis that I just sort of put forward, around the league, this idea that like new talented head coaches, people who have been assistants that people have been talking about for a while, right? Tend to do well, and there's obviously like the reason they were talking about for a while, but we're seeing it with like
Fizdale, yeah,
yeah. Budenholzer in Atlanta, like a couple years ago.
Hornets, Steve Clifford.
Steve Clifford, sure. We've seen this, and I think that a fundamental part of that, Spoelstra maybe even actually is like the platonic ideal of this. Obviously, they have a certain degree of basketball acumen that makes them like sought after assistants. But then I think the follow to that is that these younger dudes, they have this built in, like the stakes are the same for both them and the players, right? Like they want to make it so that they can exist in the NBA and like carve out a space in the NBA doing what they love to do. Thibodeau doesn't have that same stakes because he did that already, right? And so it's this question of finding shared stakes with his players beyond the sort of abstract, like we want to win a title, and finding a more relatable space for that. I don't know how true that is, but I think that like that's something I want to look into and do a little research on, because I think it bears thinking about.
Well, I don't know if it's something that you can research, but like it's like a psychological connection that you can assume is a thing. I'm willing to give it like as much credence as you can give psychology as like a science. Hot take. But you know, so I'm willing to say like, okay, this is like a real thing. Insofar as like, it is an easy way to establish that connection. Like whether or not like it is, you know, transcends other issues the coach might have, or whether or not it's the best way to do it. Or, you know, some of the other qualifying statements around, sure, like, this is a way that you can make a connection with your team, I'm not so sure about. But, like, yeah, it seems like a very good way on face value to make a connection with your team. And, like, maybe a good coach can be a great coach in circumstances like that in a way that a, you know, different coach might not be able to.
Right. I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at. I think that, like, Luke Walton has, like, a psychological head start, or so does Fizdale, something like that, on someone like Thibodeau.
I mean, he's Luke Walton. Yeah. Thank you for listening to Almighty Ballin, the Almighty Podcast. Follow at Almighty Ballin, at MLS Earthboard.
Yep, that's me, the MLS Earthboard. The official Earthboard of Major League Soccer.
ML Surfboard, that's my co-host for today, Michael Luxembourg, in the flesh, except not in the flesh, electronically. He's got, you know, there's this camel painting in the background. It's good.
Yeah. It's a tapestry.
Yeah. There's a tapestry. So coming to you live from, you know, our separate places, not in the Almighty Ballin Studios. It's me, a tapestry, and Michael Luxembourg. You know, thank you for listening. Follow, follow those Twitter accounts I already said, and like almightyballer.com on Facebook, and check out the rest of these shows on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network at almightyballer.com.
Subscribe and review on iTunes.
Don't review, please, on iTunes. People only say mean things about me, even when they give it 5 stars. They say,
so review on smelling iTunes and say nice things about our friend Chris.
Yeah. I'm just kidding. But hey, look forward to next time. My new microphone I got for myself for Christmas, in its full glory. I'm going to sound so good. It's going to be crazy. the vast majority of you won't notice. But make sure you listen to it anyways to see if you can.
Yeah, listen extra close. See if you're in the minority that does notice.
You're in the minority? Thanks. Good night.
All right, bye.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison, here to tell you GEICO has more than just great savings. Much more. GEICO's been around for more than 75 years, back when they were using Morse code. Sorry, that's just my sense of humor. What's more, with GEICO, you get 24/7 access to licensed agents on the app, online, or over the phone, so you can talk to them at night or in the morning. So forevermore, just know that no other auto insurer has more than GEICO. More power to you. GEICO. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.